From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Barry Hannah. The Mississippi native has been writing short stories and novels for over 30 years. Truman Capote once called him the maddest writer in the USA. Over the years, Hannah has mellowed, but he's still fascinated by violence and characters that embody evil. His new novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, is his first in 10 years. MTV celebrates its 20th anniversary tomorrow with an all-day retrospective and a primetime concert. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, looks back on the music channel's past 20 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Danielle Irby. The House has approved a ban on all human cloning. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from the Capitol.
The measure would make it illegal to artificially create a human life using genetic material from just one other person. It would also ban all medical research that uses a form of cloning. The House voted down lawmakers who contend that research ban might prevent efforts to find cures for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. Some scientists want to use a method called therapeutic cloning to create human stem cells. They'd be used for stem cell research, which many lawmakers favor in some form. Opponents of the ban say therapeutic cloning could lead to other medical advances, but the bill's supporters contend the risk is too great. They contend that allowing any form of cloning might open the way for creating cloned babies. Some, though not all, anti-abortion lawmakers also say that destroying cloned embryos in research would be morally wrong. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, the Capitol.
White House officials and lawmakers on Capitol Hill are sending mixed messages about progress on negotiations over a patient's bill of rights. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Bush administration officials worked into the night Monday with aides to Georgia Republican Congressman Charlie Norwood, who's spearheading negotiations on behalf of a bipartisan group of House members and senators. But while White House officials say a compromise is near, Norwood's allies don't seem quite as confident. Following a meeting to update them on the talks, the sponsors of the measure Mr. Bush has vowed to veto said they were prepared to offer a relatively minor concession on protecting employers from lawsuits. But they said they've still not engaged with the administration on larger issues regarding patients' rights to sue health insurers. With or without a deal, the House could vote on a bill as soon as Wednesday. Julie Rovner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The deadliest attack in Mideast violence in 2 months is drawing sharp criticism from the Bush administration and the State Department. 8 Palestinians were killed when Israeli forces fired into offices of the Hamas headquarters. Israel says several senior members of the Hamas movement were killed in the attack, which also killed 2 children who were outside. The State Department says targeted killings of Palestinians and the killing and wounding of innocent civilians on both sides in the conflict are reprehensible. Firefighters say the wildfire that has scorched nearly 4,500 acres in Wyoming's Jackson Hole Valley is now 75% contained. Roger Stilipek is the spokesman for the Green Knoll Fire Information Center, and he says the weather has been a big help.
The fire is currently 75% contained. Total personnel committed, 1,339. That includes 34 fire crews. We also have 33 engines and 11 helicopters committed to the fire effort.
Some residents are now being allowed back into their homes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 121 points. This is NPR. The Code Red Worm is expected to make another appearance tonight. Computer users around the world have been put on alert for the worm, which could cause widespread slowdowns on the internet and possibly shut down some sites at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. But experts say it doesn't wipe out information on a hard drive, and they don't think it will affect home personal computers. The United States Postal Service has announced that one of its tractor-trailer trucks was hijacked near Atlanta's Hartsfield International Airport on July 21st. Georgia Public Radio's Maura Farrelly reports.
Postal authorities say a car pulled in front of the fully loaded 40,000-ton truck and that a man carrying a firearm then forced the driver to a remote location where an as-of-yet undetermined quantity of mail was unloaded and stolen. U.S. Postal Inspector Judy Luther says authorities aren't sure if the thief were after a specific piece of mail, but that he did seem to target certain bags.
We do know that the person did take accountable mail, which would be mail similar to certified, insured, registered mail.
Authorities are now trying to identify the senders of that registered mail. They're asking people in the Metro Atlanta area to be on the lookout for empty mailbags. For NPR News, I'm Maura Farrelly in Atlanta.
United Nations peacekeepers will remain in Lebanon for six more months. The UN Security Council has voted unanimously to keep the peacekeepers in place, but made clear it wants to end the 23-year-old UN mission as soon as possible. The UN force was responsible for verifying Israel's withdrawal from southern Lebanon, assisting the Lebanese government in reclaiming authority in the area, and helping to restore peace. I'm Danielle Irby, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna. Larry McMurtry has called him the best fiction writer to appear in the South since Flannery O'Connor. William Styron described Hanna as an original and one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. Hanna writes about the American South. He grew up in Mississippi and has taught for many years at the University of Mississippi. He has won the William Faulkner Prize, been nominated for an American Book Award, and was a National Book Award finalist. The title of his new book, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, borrows a line from the Dylan song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. There are orphans and guns in the novel, and plenty of evil, as a killer changes the lives of everyone around him in a small Mississippi community. Hanna wrote the novel while getting chemotherapy treatments for lymphoma. Let's start with Hanna introducing a short reading from the book.
This is Man Mortimer, who is the evil that lurks in this book, and he likes to cut people. He comes from Missouri, and there's a little piece about him. At this juncture, he had no plans to hurt people around the lake. He did not like bodies of water much, had never seen the ocean. He was indifferent to trees. Soil was hateful to him, as was the odor of fish. But like many another man, 45 years in age, he wanted his youth back. He wanted to have pals, sports, high school girls. This need had rushed on him lately. He lived in three houses, but he had no home. He did not like the hearth, smells from the kitchen, an old friend for a wife, small talk. It all seemed a vicious closet to him. He moved, he took, he was admired. But he had developed a taste for young and younger flesh. This was thrilling and meant high money. Men and women in this nation were changing, and he intended to charge them for it. Religion had neither formed nor harmed him. Neither had his parents in southern Missouri. But he despised the weakness of the church and of his parents, whom he had gulled. He was a pretty boy born of hawk-nosed people. He was a curse to have these looks and no talent. Long, lank, hooded eyes, sensual lips that sang no tune. Still, he quit the football team because of what it did to his hair, claiming a back ailment that had exempted him from manual labor since age 14. There are thousands of men of this condition, most of them sorry and shiftless, defeated at the start. Many are compulsives and snarling fools, emeritus at 20.
Is this character of Man Mortimer based on anyone?
No, he's not. He's a compound, and I've gotten, just by looking around and believing that I perceived evil in front of me. So it is imaginative, but a collected history of my impressions, I believe.
You describe him as a quiet man, a gambler, a liaison for stolen cars, and a runner of whores, including three Vicksburg housewives. Describe his kind of crime.
His kind of crime is a kind of crime that begins out of laziness and being admired by women. He finds he can make a living at it, and he continues since he ran away from home in high school. He's not been particularly violent, but he has induced violent suicides in others. He is a thief. He has a stolen car ring, especially expensive SUVs. He's a man who doesn't like to work, and he doesn't like much of what's offered by nature. So I feel him as an alien without real pals and only a commercial connection to women. He wants to join in society now, but he only knows how to hurt, and that's the base of the book. Evil, when it reaches out to you and when it befriends you, and in Mortimer's case, he likes to use a knife. He's dangerous, and he has made quite a deal of money off the casino life around Vicksburg.
Why did you want to create a character who embodies evil?
I have been fascinated with how evil goes unpunished, even unseen, in this life. And I wanted the evil to work on a group of folks I have already imagined in my short stories around a beautiful lake of my youth. And I thought the evil that Mortimer represented would give each of them decisions to make. And it would give a focus to their lives. So that I suppose I am just interested in evil and what it does to folks in a community.
Has evil, like Man Mortimer's kind of evil, ever come into your life?
I've been around it. Usually, evil is something you can't face. It simply has to wear out. Sometimes you work for evil unwittingly, and I can't think of a particular person right now, but I think I've felt the closeness of evil in casinos. And it brings out the old Baptist in me. I find the wretched excess and the sort of zombified folks that attend and participate in casinos pathetic and also dangerous in many cases.
Now, what about violence? There's some violence in this book. Has violence come into your life? Have you witnessed it? Have you ever had a violent streak yourself?
I like to throw knives back in my drinking days, but no, I've never been personally violent. I can't be an honest man, though, and tell you, but that I am occupied by violence. It seems to be out of my nightmares. And my wife wishes I wouldn't write about violence, but as soon as the pen starts going, I become interested in it all over again. And it's as if it's almost dictated to me, because I've been writing for 35 years, and it's attended a good deal of my work. At this point, I don't think I can do anything but confess that I am a student of violence, because of what it does, because of how it quickens the character of those around it.
You've also collected guns, right?
I've collected guns, yes.
And have you used them? What kind of things do you use them for?
I have not used a gun in 10 years. Mm-hmm. If I used them right now, I'd shoot beer cans at the city dump. It's a 22 rifle. Now, I don't have any real personal urge to shoot anymore. It just passed. And I've never shot at a human being, never threatened a human being, if that's covering the subject.
So what did you use the guns for?
You know, this is a difficult thing to explain to others about how a gun is a piece of art. Guns are history. I like to look at the mechanism. I like to feel the heft. And they are a kind of history. So that's about all I can say. I don't collect guns anymore, but I'm not sorry for the ones I have. They just feel like a decent hunk of the past hanging on the wall.
You say that whenever you pick up the pen, you end up starting to write about violence. What is it, do you think, about violence that's so seductive in fiction or in movies? And, you know, I wouldn't compare your new novel to an action film, but there just seems to be something that people gravitate to in stories of violence.
Yeah, they gravitate toward it. By the way, I have done calm pieces, meditative pieces, even religious pieces, and that are without violence. But I don't know why the preoccupation, especially, except that it wakes up my imagination. And I may be a tragic case. It may be that the good does not light up my imagination as much as the evil. It may be a personal failure. But I am trying my best to get through this phase, and I do love hard drama, and I will imagine it in different ways, in several ways in the future, I'm sure.
My guest is writer Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Barry Hanna is my guest. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Everyone in your book is quite damaged in some way or another. Why is that?
Well, you know, I noticed the New York Times reviewer said that this book was a parade of gargoyles, and there are damaged folks in it. I think that people are needing to mend around a lake. A lake is a great contemplative body for me, and lakes have soothed me all my life. And I think that the wounded and those in despair might naturally gather around such a lake to live. I do not think my characters are particularly grotesque. My honest view of how folks live, and I have those fans of mine who don't really see them as terribly eccentric, or painting them as obsessive, they think they're looking at life straight on. When you look at all of us, you're going to find a kind of private hurt that can be monstrous, and our private obsessions are very strange to others if they knew them. That's about all.
No, I think you wrote most of this novel after being diagnosed with lymphoma, and some of it while taking chemotherapy treatments. Were you feeling kind of particularly damaged yourself when you were writing, physically damaged?
Yeah, and that probably contributes to the themes of damage in the book. I hadn't considered that, but my wife read the book, and she said, you know, this is very dark. And I had told a buddy of mine, very close to me, Dan Williams, you're going to have fun with this one, Dan. There's a lot of exuberance. And when it was finished, it was darker than I knew. I do think I was writing out of some real obsession with mortality and physical pain, and on steroids some of the time. Well, the steroids were my only energy. They're the only drug that kept me standing during the chemotherapy. But I believe that you're right on the money. I do think my occupations were with death, with us facing hurt, and I also hope you don't miss the humor that saves us in the book.
Mm. How uncertain has the outcome been of your treatments?
Well, it's been good. I mean, I've been without cancer for a year.
Good.
And so I'm a hopeful and happy and very grateful man.
How do you think the exhaustion of being sick and taking chemo affected your will to write, your ability to write, the style that you wrote in?
You know, I really can't answer for that. I know that much came in a rush, private inner rushes, and that it was composed in tranquility that became a little more panicked and more panicked as I wrote, because I got deeper into treatment and into weakness. So it was a book that may be paced beginning with kind of a healthy or just clinical observations about folks, and then it becomes maybe more frantic.
It takes a lot of endurance to write. I mean, I think it's a pretty exhausting, mentally exhausting occupation, physically not so much so, because you're just sitting in a chair. Were you surprised at how much energy it took to write?
Yeah, I've never been this weak in my life, and I was shocked by weakness, which just accompanies the treatment. And I agree it takes a lot of energy and a lot of muscular strength. I mean, I use a pencil, and I love all of these tools, but it never had occurred to me what a vast physical job writing was until this book, because in my earlier books, I had trouble keeping up with my pencil. The stories were coming so hot and heavy. In this one, this was a rather long and very exhausting view into a force that weakened me personally. I had 100 pages more than this book was, and it was cleaned up and helped beautifully by my editor, Amy Hundley, and by my wife also. My wife typed the manuscript. I was, for the first time in my life, very, very dependent on the women around me, and very beholden and full of love for these people.
Let me get back to your novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan. There's a bar in which the novel opens. It's called the Walnut Bar. I want you to describe this bar.
This bar is one of the few surviving. I'm turning the pages now. I'm looking into what it is. It's a roadhouse, really. It's with a little bait. He's the man who still has roaches for bait, which is really unheard of since the 50s almost. But he's a wise man in the ways of fishing. He advises folks on depth and lures and the wind. He's a bard. Men come there because it has none of the trappings of a woman about it. It has a calendar of a naked, bosomy girl on the wall, and it evokes the 50s around the Korean War. So it's where men gather in different places in the South, to be men and to talk manly. And it's a rough place, but it's also kind of a church. The bar is Walnut. As far as I know, it's unnamed. And it also is unlicensed. So the sheriff allows it or disallows it to be open. What it is a mecca for fishermen. And every fisherman I know who's serious about going long distances to fish will know something about a roadhouse like this.
Whereas I know nothing about a roadhouse like this, and I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman or because I'm from the North or because I'm from the city, but, you know, I was reading this and I'm thinking, I've never had the experience of being in a bar like this.
There's no reason why you should, Terry. I wouldn't go in there if I were a woman. There's nothing attractive unless you fish and you just see a sort of rugged charm about the folks. It's pretty pathetic, really, when it's on merits. But he does have good whiskey, which he overcharges for, and he's got tales. He's telling stories about people around the lake. So he is kind of the Homer of the place. And the people are disappointed in him, in fact. He's now got a videotape he's selling behind the counter, which is close to child pornography. And it's the two men that we're introduced to, Robbie and Cecil, are sad that he's joined the modern times. But we find, of course, that Man Mortimer himself is doing local films with orphan girls. It's not an attractive place. There's no reason for anybody to go there except rough and kind of manly fishermen who are trying to get away from everything back at the office or the hardware store or wherever.
Barry Hanna will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. The title refers to a line in this Bob Dylan song. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. He understands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue. The highway is for gamblers, better use your sense. Take what you have gathered from coincidence. The empty-handed painter from your streets is drawing crazy patterns on your sheets. The sky, too, is folding under you, and it's all over now, baby blue. All your seasick sailors, they're all rowing home.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer Barry Hanna talks about growing up in the South, and David Bianculli considers the 20th anniversary of MTV.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna. His new novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, is about an evil man, a killer who changes the lives of everyone in a small community in Mississippi. William Styron has called Hanna one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. You grew up in Mississippi. You used to live in Mississippi. What are some of the things you think most separate Southern culture from Northern culture?
Oh, Gad. There's still a relatively unhurried here when you get out of the big urban centers like Nashville and Atlanta, which are very cosmopolitan now. They're very much like a lot of the nation. But there's a world of difference between a football crowd in at a Vandy Ole Miss game and a Penn State crowd. I can tell by experience. There is just a leisure about the culture and a kind of love of jokes, and especially old times. People in the South are nostalgic by age 11. And I say that in the book, but it's not a joke. It's looking back even to poverty as a great old time. We have a great yearning for a softer, quieter, kinder times. I think we're just afflicted with that Irish look at the past as a comfort and a joy. And we celebrate the past a great deal more than other places.
Did you grow up like that, always looking back?
I certainly did.
On what? What were the things that you were brought up to be nostalgic about?
My mother was from Delta Planters, and I heard her stories about boats coming up to their plantation full of oysters and candy and mints, and it sounded like an outpost in Africa. And I mean, my mother was, you know, born back at the turn of the century, 1906 or something, and that it seemed, it was so happy, Christmas time, so happy to get these things up from New Orleans on a big boat. It sounded like the best times available. I'm just sounding happy. And I listen to those stories, and now I am just as nostalgic as my mother for very modest homes down on the coast of Mississippi. Very sweet people with no money, a lot of gentility, natural, and affection for family. I had a very wonderful youth, and I was babied as a late child, and I had every opportunity to be what I wanted to be, and one of the best things they gave me was pleasant and gentle memories of family.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up in Clinton, Mississippi, which is right outside the state capital in Jackson. But it was a distinct village, about 2,000 people, with a little college, a little Baptist college. So that we had professors and for neighbors, and the culture of the Baptist church, the high school band, and the football team. That was it. That was civilization as I knew it. Also, there was no crime. We disappeared sometimes in the summer at 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't come back until 7 at night. There was no fear because we, the whole village took care of us.
Did you go to the Baptist church?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
What was the oratory like in the church, and do you think that influenced your sense of storytelling or the way you write?
The preachers did not, but the Bible itself has. The rhythms of the Old and New Testament, in the King James Version, are just as solidly set in a person of my era who went to church as a marble foundation. I make my sentences, I'm sure, from biblical rhythms. I've been called postmodernist, but I doubt it. I think I just write in more fragmented ways and narration, but the base of my sentences, although they are sometimes baroque, is, I think, from the scriptures, as far as I can feel it myself.
Was the Bible for you mostly an oral work that you heard preachers read out loud in church, or was it a book that you read to yourself?
Both. The preachers interpreted, and actually the Protestant faiths have become almost Catholic in not reading the Bible. They become the preachers have become sole interpreters of the Bible, whereas the original Baptist idea was that every man was his own interpreter with no intercession. Yeah, we read a lot of the Bible. We knew scriptures by heart, especially Psalms and a great bit of the book of John, the Sermon on the Mount and from Matthew, and certain things like that were memorized. And I had them memorized until I was 15, 16 years old.
Can you think of a line or a passage from the Bible that has the kind of rhythms that you're speaking of and how they influenced you?
Yes, it's something like the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow, and so on. This has just such wonderful, basic human poetry in it. And I never was sophisticated enough to consider the Bible as literature until I never even heard the term the Bible as literature until I was way into graduate school. So I'd stopped going to church, but the church is, the scriptures are very much with me, and more now I'm reading Mark and John in the Bible. Not all the time, but I just love the clarity and the mystery at the same time.
I know when I was young and the Bible was read out loud in our assemblies every week in grade school, and when I would hear, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," I was just confused. Like, well, why wouldn't I want him then? I didn't realize that want could mean lack.
Right. You wouldn't want.
Yeah, why don't I want him? Yeah. I shall not want. Okay. Were you ever confused by the language?
I was confused constantly. Either the Southern pronunciation on things or the preacher's interpretation of things, I always adored Christ. That never has left me, but I was totally confused by God. And I remain confused. But I give large attention to Christ, and I do believe, like Thomas Jefferson said, the best code of morals we've ever had. And that goes deep into me. And if you get sick and there's nothing left but for you, but Christ and a few pals, you tend to become deep in your religious mind. I had an inner vision of Christ after a week after I almost died of pneumonia. And I didn't expect it. In the dream, I said, I haven't been paying enough attention to you. And he was very physical, and he made no comment, but he gave me to believe that he was there. And it just shocked me, because I've not been a very wonderful Christian in a pronounced way. But he is still there deeply in me. I know part of it is cultural, but also a great deal of it is very real.
My guest is writer Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Did you grow up reading a lot of the literature of the South? Did the fact that you were from the South affect your choices in what to read or the things that you were assigned in school?
I did not read the literature of the South. I only heard the great names spoken, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams. I was not literary a bit, frankly, until I went to high school. I got a high school class and started reading some Keats. And then I think next was Jack London. So I'm a schooled literary man. It wasn't just instantly available in the house.
What was it about Keats that did it for you?
I think it was the Ode on a Grecian Urn, and I had such a good teacher, Mrs. Lois Blackwell, that made that thing come alive, and I could see the joy in language and how somebody could get rapturous over beauty. And also knowing that he died at 26 interested me because I was like 17, and that seemed like a pretty decent lifespan then, you know? And so you just get the move on, you can get your poems in. Die at 26 and be famous. So that was actually kind of inviting to the stupid boy in school like me.
Did that give you also this romantic sense of an early death?
It may have. It may have. And I've since shed that.
Right.
There's not a damn thing glorious about tuberculosis, and everybody who knows that disease knows that it should be de-romancified, as they said about Orwell, who had it too. It used to be the writer's disease, and I kind of even wanted it. Anything to get you to pure ecstasy in words, I thought I was willing to bear.
So you thought fever could give you a vision?
Right, right. Fever and then liquor for several years. And so I went my way in liquor, which is almost a boring story with writers. But I thought you needed it for insight, and my heroes had become Faulkner and Joyce and Hemingway. We all slugged it back. And I thought it liberated vision, and it does make you more comfortable with saying anything you want to. It may have made me a little funnier, sometimes a little wittier, but the fallout was negative, as it always is, if continued.
Well, some people have a constant editor sitting on their shoulder. You know, there's an editor part of their own personality that's always silencing the writer, and it's a very inhibiting experience. Did you have that, and did alcohol get rid of the editor?
I think you've just put your hand on the exact problem. Yeah, it made me better at parties. It made other people more interesting, as Jack Nicholson said, giving the reason why he drank. You were just a happy old thing, and the same thing when you sat down to the typewriter. Your inhibitions go away. And I think if you can limit it to like two whiskeys, there's something to be said for it. That you are looser, you actually are friendlier to the universe and more inviting to strangers, and you can imagine other people a little better. Now I just have coffee, and I think I do it pretty well, but I do want to caution the young that it's you neither want alcoholism nor tuberculosis nor any of the things that have killed off many wonderful people like Jimi Hendrix, and whom I still miss. You just got to gut it and be more stubborn and trust your own head.
Were you an obnoxious drinker? If you had too many, were you difficult?
Sure, especially in the last years. I haven't had a drink in 11 years, but, oh, yes, I lost a marriage because of it. It's everything that's in the book. It's unbearable, especially as you grow older. An old drunk is really a pitiful thing.
Barry Hanna is my guest, and his new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Have you ever gone through a real dry period writing where it just wouldn't come and you gave up?
Yes. But I think that's what it's good to teach and have a regular paycheck, because I go for some months without inspiration, and it frightens me deeply. Nobody wants to be out of gas. Nobody wants to repeat himself. So these are frightening times, and I was keeping a journal to try to help myself. I've heard that it helps, but my journal was full of such banal thoughts, I wouldn't dare let anybody read them. I was just like taking out the dog, and it's raining today, and I had no great thoughts unless I was working. And that's the way it's been. I just don't think. My thoughts are very average, ordinary. Until I get among people and language, I think I do have some thoughts then, and there's my real work, my mental life. You just wait out these periods. I think it's good. You know, there are already too many books, and you want to save it until you're ready and you can do your best. And then when those days come, that's just a wonderful feeling, because you I get up at 4 in the morning and full of joy, go into those notebooks, and I just feel like I'm the luckiest man in the world.
You mentioned before that you've been cancer-free for a year. Do you still have to take any kind of treatments?
No, not, unless it recurs. And even then, there are new drugs to help me along. And I kill the cancer. So I don't know how to feel, frankly. I have the attitude of a healthy man, but I'm not quite healthy yet. And I just remain grateful that I got to do this book we're talking about, and that I'm talking with a pleasant and intelligent woman like you. I'm not. There's nothing to gain by my coming on to you at this point, but I do appreciate it. This is nice. This is very, 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 very nice, and I'm flattered by your attention.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Barry Hanna, his new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. The 100th anniversary of Louis Armstrong's birth is Saturday, August 4th. According to his birth certificate, even though Armstrong said he was born July 4th, 1900, we'll celebrate on Thursday with Michael Cogswell, the director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archive. We'll listen to excerpts of home recordings Armstrong made. In the meantime, here's one of his classic recordings. This is Weatherbird, featuring Armstrong with Earl Hines, recorded in 1928. Louis Armstrong and Earl Hines. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on MTV's 20th anniversary. This is Fresh Air. The cable music channel MTV turns 20 years old tomorrow and is celebrating its birthday with an all-day retrospective of influential videos and a primetime live concert featuring many familiar acts from Billy Idol to Busta Rhymes. For the occasion, TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts about MTV then and now.
My daughter is 19 years old, about to start her sophomore year of college. My son is 17, a high school senior. Neither of them has ever known a world without MTV, which turns 20 tomorrow. They're both part of what has often been called the MTV generation. Bob Thompson, who teaches popular culture at Syracuse University, points out that the mere fact that MTV has a generation named after it shows how important it is. CNN doesn't have a generation, neither does HBO. And when I was a kid, I wasn't part of the CBS generation. I was a member of the TV generation, period. That's quite a leap in one generation, from being identified with a new medium in general to being linked with one channel out of hundreds in a cable universe that many millions of people in this country can't get or don't watch. When I started watching TV as a child in the 50s, the TV was an appliance with only a handful of channels and a smudgy black and white picture. After the late movie or before the morning farm report, TV didn't show anything but a test pattern. The picture often went screwy, and you had to adjust the horizontal hold or the vertical hold to keep it from rolling. Color TV? That didn't arrive in our house until the late 60s, when I first found out there was a big difference between Kansas and Oz in The Wizard of Oz. Since we only had a black and white set, it had all seemed the same. My kids, though, were born with cable. They've never known rabbit ears or TVs without remote controls. Technology can make you feel very old very fast. And I feel even older because when MTV was launched 2 decades ago, I was a TV critic then, watching it at the very beginning. What MTV did then was take the term cable network launch and use launch as a metaphor. Its symbol those first few years was an MTV logo superimposed on a lunar flag. And if you tuned in, waiting to watch MTV that very first day, the sound you heard was Mission Control from NASA, and the picture was that of an Apollo rocket on the launching pad. When the countdown hit zero, the rocket and MTV took off. And the first video, by a group named the Buggles, was called Video Killed the Radio Star.
T-minus 45 seconds and counting. T-minus 40 seconds and counting. The development flight instrumentation recorders are on. T-minus 35 seconds. We're just a few seconds away from switching to the redundant sense sequencer. T-minus 27 seconds. We have gone for redundant sense sequencer start. T-minus 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15, 14, 13, T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
There were 13 videos shown that first hour, from The Who's You Better You Bet to Pat Benatar's You Better Run. Benatar, before Madonna, was MTV's first sex symbol. The first host we saw then, identified by MTV as a video jockey or VJ, was Mark Goodman, the 1981 equivalent of Carson Daly. The power of MTV over the years is evident in music, on radio, on television, in the movies, and in fashion. Videos, as they developed into dramatic mini-movies, paved the way for Miami Vice and Flashdance and a whole new vocabulary of film and editing. Big hair and spandex were spread like a virus by MTV in the 80s. And because of MTV, Michael Jackson and Madonna are superstars. But MTV's power also is measurable in what it doesn't show. Before Michael Jackson, it had an unofficial ban against black artists. Today, after such shows as Yo MTV Raps, there's no question MTV helped spread hip-hop into the heartland. If MTV had been even more inclusionary, adding jazz and soul and folk as well as electronica and newer musical movements, who knows how taste for this new generation might have been shaped. Right now, some of the biggest things around are the good-looking boy bands and sexy girl singers. MTV deserves a lot of blame for that, but I have a hard time getting upset about it. On my first color TV, one of the shows I remember watching was a TV series about a music group whose members were assembled specifically for that show. Today, that would be Eden's Crush, an all-girl group formed on the WB reality series Pop Stars, and now singing and gyrating on MTV. Back in my day, it was a boy band called The Monkees, in a sitcom that included goofy short films that looked an awful lot like MTV videos. Come to think of it, people my age should consider themselves fortunate. At least we weren't stuck with the label of the monkey generation.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Barnes & Noble, presenting Nancy Griffith's new CD, Clock Without Hands, a studio album featuring 14 new Nancy Griffith songs. The CD includes the first single, Where Would I Be? This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Sarah Jessica Parker talks about her HBO series Sex and the City in an onstage interview we recorded a couple of weeks ago on Martha's Vineyard. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.